This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner. It's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
With David Canfield.
Hi.
And with Rebecca Ford.
Hello.
If you're listening in the United States, happy Thanksgiving. We are recording this ahead of the holiday, of course, but we want to talk about the movies that people may be watching either on screeners or in theaters over the long holiday weekend here in the States. We'll talk about some news in the world of awards. We'll talk about some new releases like The Color Purple. And then at the end of the show, we're going to have a special bonus Thursday interview. David Canfield talked to the star of Napoleon, Vanessa Kirby. So let's talk about award show news. I don't know how many people were waiting with bated breath to find out where the Golden Globes are going to air, but I know we were. I know all of us were wondering, and we're kind of genuinely surprised when the news broke last week that they'll be on CBS, which I, you know, according to Matt Bellany in his newsletter, they had gone to CBS multiple times and kind of came back with a lower number, which makes sense to me. I don't think it would have taken this long if they had gotten a lucrative network contract from the very beginning. But what do we think? Like, the Golden Globes are turning to actual broadcast. This is a good sign for the future of the Golden Globes, I think, right?
It is.
Against all odds.
Against all odds, it is. And I kind of think a perfect network for them. You know, CBS skews older, even by the standards of broadcast networks, and has that legacy audience that matches, from what I can tell, the Golden Globes are trying to project, which is this sort of... storied, not scandal-ridden place in Hollywood history, because there are a lot of awards shows right now. And once everything started, you know, that House of Cards came down with the HFPA, the conversation around the show was like, well, why does it have to be them? They're just a bunch of random people voting. It can literally be any awards that get this profile. And their counter was always like, how long they've been around, how long they've been on television, what the brand means. And this seems like a really effective way of leveraging that, and that they did that successfully.
Yeah, I think it's a huge win for them. I had been joking, I think, for months that it was just going to end up on Variety.com. So this is which is a Penske,
which is literally what the Billboard Music Awards did.
Yeah, which
they aired last night as we record this, like on some random website,
which most people would not know because it was on some random website. So, I mean, CBS is a big win for them, especially when it comes to getting talent to show up for this. I think there's no doubt in my mind now that, you know, everyone will come because it will be on broadcast. And yeah, CBS is the home of the Tonys and the Grammys. So, you know, they're already sort of known for this. So I think it's a good win, but it sounds like, you know, at a much, much lower licensing fee than the deal they previously had with NBC.
The Tonys, the Golden Globes, what a cursed award show is CBS going to acquire next? I mean,
don't say the Oscars.
No. The Oscars are bigger than ever.
The next question is, who do they get to host? Which I think will be interesting to kind of sit and watch because they've got to announce soon. I mean, this is a January 7th awards show, so we're...
Yeah, that's the other thing, is it's so rapidly approaching, and, you know, we're recording this the week of Thanksgiving. Things start slowing down very quickly in Hollywood around this time, and then suddenly everybody's back, and as we've talked about, January is going to be insane, and this is kind of the kickoff to that insanity, at least in L.A. So I would imagine they're working pretty hard to put everything together right now and make it something that people are going to watch, because even with that lower licensing fee, I'm sure there are a lot of pressure on delivering to a certain extent, because the ratings fell pretty significantly on NBC last year.
Do you think a host is necessary for building up that profile? Because the Golden Globes functioned without a host for a long time, I think, like until the Ricky Gervais era. So like, could they just focus on getting the talent to come and let the host thing be secondary?
I kind of think it's important if you're communicating a sort of return to grandeur with this show. While you're completely right, I think at this point in the popular imagination, it does exist as the show that had Tina Fey and Amy Poehler or Ricky Gervais, comics who could effectively skewer the people in the room a little bit more bite than at the Oscars. That's kind of how it has stood in the culture the last few years, at least the last few years that it was a big deal. So I think they'll want to do that. I think they will want to communicate, we are back. We are bigger than ever, and we are going to throw the biggest party of the year because that was always the sell.
You think they're going to invite Gerard Carmichael back?
No.
I mean, no. It was never their thing, but I wonder how much like CBS pushes for a CBS talent sort of situation, or if that doesn't even matter. Like, I don't even know who that would be. It's like Jeff Probst, or who do we get?
Taylor Tomlinson, who's taking James Corden's slot, I guess.
NCIS LA's own Linda Hunt.
Sure.
Wow.
Yeah, Oscar winner. Or Chris O'Donnell and LL Cool J. They're all on the same show.
LL Cool J hosted the Grammys a couple times. I feel like he has some award show host experience. Sure.
Carrie Preston should do it. She has her own CBS show coming out.
The Holdover's own Carrie Preston?
Yeah. Yeah.
What a great idea.
It is kind of interesting though, talking about who could potentially host and just thinking about how like the Amy and Tina years weren't that long ago. I guess 10 years ago at this point. But like do we have people like that anymore? Like, I just feel like network television is not churning out, like, you know, there's not the SNL, the sitcom pipeline there was back then. And I don't know. It's just an odd thing to think about that we sort of don't have that same pool of talent to pull from.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about I was thinking about somebody like a John Mulaney, but he's not as big as they are, as they were.
Right.
But I think he probably occupies that kind of niche and would do a good job, I think.
He and, was it Nick Kroll did Indie Spirits together? Mm-hmm. And they were so good. I mean, that show allows them a lot more freedom, but he's a great host. Yeah, it wouldn't be a bad idea.
And they're a little bit bigger in profile now than they were back then.
Mm-hmm. But is that a CBS vibe? Like, is that what you would think their audience is going to want to go
and be like, who is this man?
Well, they could do it as their Oh Hello characters from Broadway, the old men, and just like fit right into the demographic.
So what you're saying, Katie, is this is the comeback for Jeff Foxworthy that we've been waiting for.
Oh my God.
You might be an HFPA member if...
Well, the Golden Globe nominations are going to be announced on December 11th. They'll come on the heels of, I know, the New York Film Critics Circle, probably LA, some other critics groups. But that will be a very interesting point for hopefully some chaotic nominations that we always hope for. But maybe then we'll get a sense of which names are going to be there, which celebrities they nominated just for the sake of showing up, and kind of the proper Golden Globes anticipation can begin.
The Run for Revogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that.
Yeah, we support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, then speaking of award shows and the Oscars, our deeply personal favorite, Rebecca, you picked up the unsurprising, but I still think interesting news that Jimmy Kimmel is coming back to host the Oscars. I would have put money on that. How about you?
Yeah, it's not surprising, except when I started to like really think about Kimmel and how, you know, after he hosted those two back-to-back years, he was like, I'm never doing it again. And then he came back last year. And I'm like, sir. Last year went really, really well, I think. You know, most people were very happy with how he just delivered a calm, normal show. And, you know, he's really great at hosting. So it's and obviously it's ABC. So it's not a huge surprise other than when I tried to get into the like psyche of Jimmy Kimmel. But yeah, I think it's a very smart, safe pick, it feels like.
Yeah, and I think one of the issues that I've had with him as a host in the past is that, like, he seems maybe more than a little kind of disdainful of the whole thing. You know, he doesn't really care about the movies. He thinks so the award shows are kind of dumb. And, like, you know, that's a tone that a lot of other past Oscar hosts have also incorporated in their bits, but, like, maybe a little bit less scornful than Kimmel. But this year, you're going to have at least two big Oscar movies in Oppenheimer and Barbie that, like, everybody has seen and that people do care about. So I wonder if this sort of like go-to joke of like no one's seen these movies or what is any of this? It's less easy to go to this year, I suppose.
It felt like he sort of scaled that back a little bit this year too, past ceremony. There has to be an awareness that those jokes don't land like they used to because the ratings for the Oscars alone have changed pretty dramatically, you know, in the window between when he first started hosting and now. So I think that it will be interesting to see how he meets the fact that the Oscars are, at least in television ratings, less popular than they've been, but will have movies that are more popular than they've had recognized in a very long time, at least collectively. So I'm not sure how that balance will be. Also, just going back to the Golden Globes, we didn't mention Stephen Colbert, but he's sort of their Kimmel, CBS's Kimmel. And it'll be interesting if we have like Kimmel doing the big ABC show, Colbert doing the big CBS show, etc.
Are we ready to see Kimmel dressed as Ken with the vest and everything?
How tanned will he get? There's also the rumor that I think is surprising to no one that they're trying to open the Oscars with a big Barbie medley and trying to figure out who ought to pay for it, which I think is really interesting. But I think the idea of Kimmel kind of overseeing like an Oscars that can really lay a claim to spectacle with those two huge movies, and then, you know, maybe Wonka gets some craft nominations. I don't know. Like, I'm trying to think of what the other like giant movies in there are going to be. Super Mario Brothers. I think there can be a celebratory tone to it. And I think he can be really good at that. And as being kind of the steadying, I got you through the La La Land mix up presence that I think he's really established well for himself.
Yeah. I mean, they can get the people from Oppenheimer to do the song from that movie.
Emily Blunt's going to do a solo.
Yeah. I mean, Color Purple would be a great performance. Like, just turn it more into the Tonys, you know? Like, if there's a song in your movie, come to the Oscars and perform it.
There's good musicals out there this year, even if they don't want to be marketed as such. But that's a topic for another day. Is there anyone that, like, do we think that the Oscars will ever get ambitious about their hosts? Are we stuck in this period where they think that only late night hosts can do this? Or it was, like, my continuing dream that Lady Gaga might, like, somehow get convinced to do it? Is that just never going to happen?
But how much of it is the talent is, like, this is a lose-lose job, you know? And how much of it is the Academy wanting a safe bet after a few tumultuous years? I don't think we know. I am a firm believer that most people offered this hosting job pass because what is the gain for a Gaga? You know what I mean? They are often blamed if things don't go well. So I feel like it's a risky job to take on.
I feel like we've maybe floated this in years past, but like Disney owns ABC. They also own Hulu. Have they gone out to Steve Martin and Martin Short to do it?
I think they did.
And they were just like, no, it's too much work.
Maybe they were asked to host the Emmys. I don't remember. I feel like there was certainly something out there about them and Selena Gomez being asked to host.
Definitely, I remember that.
Yeah. Oh, God, of course, right. Yes, there was the rumor that it was going to be the three of them, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which would be great. They would be amazing at it.
Yeah.
Hit the demographics, just like Only Murders in the Building does. It's the same function.
And they're on that show with Divine Joy Randolph, who will be a nominee, we're assuming.
Who can sing, and could you find her a song to perform? I don't know what it is. Have her do I'm Just Ken.
Just have the cast of Only Murders in the Building, including Meryl Streep, host the Oscars.
Now, imagining Divine Joy Randolph performing I'm Just Ken, I'm not going to get that out of my head.
It's unfortunately, whatever they do will be disappointing compared to that mental image.
Yeah, you've kind of set the bar too high already.
Although I've also been lobbying for Cillian Murphy to do I'm Just Ken, because I think that'd be hilarious.
And maybe they can do it together.
Yeah, there you go. Well, we're talking about musicals, and David, you mentioned The Color Purple as a potential big money-making nominee that could come in there. It's not coming out until Christmas, but the social embargo is up. And David and Rebecca, you guys have seen it. And David, you were there at this Fan Film Festival where like part of it showed. It's been a very interesting kind of lurking figure for a while now, where, you know, the buzz has been developing. I think we're all excited to see that Danielle Brooks is getting a lot of attention for the role that she played on Broadway so well. Where else does the buzz stand on The Color Purple right now?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, Danielle Brooks is so good in this movie, and to me was a clear standout, and I think a really strong supporting actress contender. Yeah, the buzz on this one has been building very steadily. Rebecca and I saw it a little bit early, and then out of that, I moderated an event in Savannah where they showed some clips, and the level of enthusiasm, I think, just for what they were teasing was so high that I'm not surprised that it seems to be playing really well now that it started screening. You know, it's a big, colorful, no pun intended, expansive musical that feels like we haven't really had one like that this year. We've had a few kind of stop and starts with Oscars in that genre of late, but this is such a storied property, and it's one that has the backing of Steven Spielberg and Oprah Winfrey and Quincy Jones and a really great cast. So yeah, it's just full steam ahead from this point. I think I would expect it to be in the conversation for a Best Picture nomination, for some Craft nominations, and certainly for Danielle Brooks. I think some of what I read and I agree with is that Fantasia Brino's really wonderful in the lead role, but it's a subtler performance than at least what Cynthia Erivo did on Broadway, for instance. And in a really competitive Best Actress year, I'm not sure if that gets her into the five. I'm a little skeptical right now. But it is a great performance, and I hope she doesn't get completely lost in that shuffle.
Yeah, I moderated a panel last week about for The Color Purple. It was, I think, the second screening of it in town, and I expected it to play well, but I was even shocked with how energetic the reception was. Danielle got us, you know, there were eight people on the panel. Danielle got a huge standing ovation, and then so did Fantasia. But it felt like that there was like no way Danielle would not be nominated after seeing the way this crowd received her. And there were like people in, obviously, a lot of purple, a lot of like costumes. Like, I really understood how important this story, the previous film, the stage version, you know, even the book are to a lot of people who are very excited for this new version that maybe I hadn't understood as well, you know, seeing it in a quiet screening room with David. So I think there's definitely a momentum behind it that makes me take it very seriously for awards. The crafts are very strong as well. Blitz is the director is a very good
So presence, well spoken, yeah. On it, yeah.
He really can talk about the film very passionately and his vision for it. So they have a lot of the necessary ingredients, I think, to go a long way. And I do think it could do really well theatrically because people are going to see it as an event over Christmas.
Yeah, it's a really, really beloved property, you know, all the way back to the novel. You know, when I first moved to New York, my first job in the city was selling group tickets over the phone at a call center to Broadway shows. And by far and away, The Color Purple was the number one group ticket thing, you know, church groups coming up from the Baltimore area, all over the Eastern Seaboard, basically. And I think
I love this part of your origin story, by the way, Richard. Anytime you bring this up, I'm just like, what you learned from that fascinates me.
I mean, Color Purple was the big narrative of the months that I was working there. And I think that the movie is well-timed. You know, we did have a revival on Broadway with Cynthia Erivo that had transferred from the West End. But that was long ago enough that maybe I think people are like ready for it again. If it had come out right on the heels of that, I think it might have been kind of oversaturation in some ways. Although, you know, I often forget that, like, even if a Broadway show is a big, big hit, that does not mean it has like national identity necessarily.
Yeah.
So I think for a lot of people, this is, I love the book. I've seen the Spielberg movie, and now I'm finally getting to see the musical because I didn't have the money to see it in New York or on tour or whatever. So it's going to be a first time for a lot of people, and I think there's a lot of anticipation for it, and it cannot be discounted. I feel sorry that it feels in my mind that Divine Joy Randolph is now moving down to second position in supporting actress, but like,
oh, wow,
what I've
really
heard of Danielle Brooks so far, it's like, how do you, it's, you can't ignore it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I'm a little bit like, I don't want to get too ahead of myself, but there is that very serious momentum behind her specifically. I have spoken to, so I'm curious to hear what you'll think, Richard. I have spoken to a few critic friends who aren't as high on the movie, and I wonder what those reviews are going to look like when the critical embargo breaks. Because as we know, this academy has changed and we can at times be a bit fooled by these initial sort of rousing screenings that we take part in. And that happens a little bit every year with some of these late breakers. So I don't want to get too ahead of myself. You know, I think there are people who are already like, here's your best picture sleeper. And I don't know about that, but it's really competitive in a lot of areas. And if it can sustain this starting pace, it is going to be one to watch in a lot of races.
And they have the added benefit that they're coming out post-strike. They have this cast that is extremely charismatic and seems very happy to do a lot of things together, which we've seen, you know, when these casts kind of have that momentum as a group, it really helps. So, I think it'll be a strong run for them.
You were talking about the way that the Academy has changed, David, in terms of its taste, which I think in your case meant, you know, more international, sometimes more esoteric, sometimes, you know, going the route of Parasite rather than something more blatantly crowd-pleasing. It's also gotten more diverse, as we all know, but I think we have still seen a lot of films with primarily black cast struggle at the Oscars in ways that we wouldn't have expected at this point in the race. Is there reason to be nervous about that outcome again this time?
I was just talking to another pundit over the weekend at an event about The Woman King and and what happened there.
Yeah.
Because it remains a movie that had that kind of rollout. I mean, I remember the buzz coming out of that Toronto screening. I remember the box office for that movie. Viola Davis got out there a lot, and it just completely came up short. And I mean, I think, did it get any nominations? No, right?
No.
Yeah, it was snubbed across the board. I don't think that fate will befall The Color Purple, at least to that extent. It's, first of all, a very, in the end, uplifting movie, and it's has that element of filling your heart that is really important for a broad Oscar contender. And again, it's a title everybody knows. It's a title that a very different Academy, a much wider Academy, embraced, to some extent, at least, many, many years ago.
Yeah.
So while I don't think that it's at that in that level of danger, yeah, I mean, is this the kind of movie that can win the SAG Award for Best Ensemble and then go on to get like two or three Oscar nominations and not win anything? Probably. I don't know that it's at a level of undeniability, at least at this stage, just given how we've seen the Academy treat certain commercial movies with largely black casts or all black casts. So it is an area of concern.
Do we know if it's rated PG-13 or R?
It can't be R, no.
Okay. I was thinking about how violent The Woman King was and whether or not that was
something.
I think
it's between PG and PG-13.
Okay. Yeah. Is this as like, you know, not as family friendly as Wonka, but like exactly the kind of movie you can take your whole family to, which could be another huge thing working in its favor.
I also think that if The Woman King had come out 2 months after it did, it would have been a different story. You know, that movie was kind of put out earlier in the fall and was treated as a, you know, early mid-fall action movie and not much else, even though it was written about very differently and talked about differently by some people as, you know, as a serious awards contender. Color Purple does not have to fight that branding. You know, it is already very much positioned as the big Christmas awards movie that's coming out, you know.
Yeah.
And so it has that momentum behind it already, which Woman King had to kind of fight for. And ultimately, just I don't think it had the runway to do it.
Color Purple's box office ceiling is also much higher.
Yeah.
Like it could be a huge mammoth hit. And that would be, I think, transformative for its awards chances because there's a real story behind a movie like that being so successful.
Yeah. And it's, I always think of The Greatest Showman when I think of like holiday hits and award season because like it grew so slowly that the Oscars never really got a chance to catch up. And you can imagine if it had come out a month earlier, it would have gotten more nominations. But The Color Purple is being positioned differently than that was. Like that was such an odd outlier that none of us really saw coming. And The Color Purple is like, here you go. This is your contender. I don't think it'll be harder to catch up in that way.
And also, as opposed to The Greatest Showman, the songs in Color Purple are good. So. No, I'm kidding. I like some songs in Greatest Showman.
I was listening. It came up on a Peloton ride, This Is Me. And I was like, God, it's so such a shame it didn't win the original song Oscar. And then I realized it lost to Coco. And I was like, okay, fine. that song still works.
Yeah.
I mean, the Christmas box office is, I think, a source of anxiety for a lot of people who care about these things because it's just kind of empty compared to what it might have normally been, owing to many factors that we've discussed plenty of times. But if Wonka and could The Color Purple do well? And like, maybe Aquaman, sure, why not? That would be a really good sign for everything. Like, I think there's reason to believe that might be possible. I've heard like good vague things about Wonka. I'm feeling optimistic about how this might go, even though there's so few films to choose from.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there has to be one Wonka optimist among
us. Oh, yeah, that is me.
I'm keeping
that stance until proven otherwise.
I think you've converted me. I'm expecting now to like Wonka and for it to make $50 million opening weekend.
There we go.
So
there we go.
You've ruined me.
You've heard of poptimism, now wonktimism.
I wanted to point out one more thing about The Color Purple. I didn't realize how many people are in that cast and double dipping this season. We've talked about Coleman Domingo, who has a role in this and is also in Rustin. But also Anjanou Ellis is in it and is also in Origin. And Jon Batiste is in it, I'm learning from Wikipedia, and is the subject of American Symphony. That's just so many people who are all over the season otherwise. Good for them.
Anjanou basically has a cameo, but is so lovely in said cameo.
Well, of course she is.
Yeah. It's early too, so it's a nice little entry into the movie.
Yeah. Well, speaking of me being an optimist about properties that people underestimate, I just wanted to put in a quick word about the Adam Sandler iguana movie Leo, which is on Netflix. I didn't ask you guys ahead of time. I'm just going to assume I'm the only one who's watched this movie.
That's correct, Kitty.
Yes. Well, it's pretty good. I just want to say it is delightful. I've watched it with my kids multiple times. I think where you land on Adam Sandler doing his kind of like silly for kids thing can vary greatly, and with good reason. But something about aiming directly to kids, I think, works out well about this. It's about an iguana who is a class pet. It's got plenty of silly and dumb jokes in there. But it's also about him kind of helping various fifth graders like accept themselves and accept each other and learn who they want to be in the world. And it's a musical. It is one of many other musicals out this fall, and one I had absolutely no idea was going to be that before I turned on the link from Netflix. It's got some kind of theatrical release, but it's also on Netflix. You can watch it now. I haven't looked that closely at the animated feature race. I don't have like super high hopes for it breaking in there. But I just wanted to throw it out as something that you might think you're dreading showing up on Netflix and having to watch with your family over the holidays, but might surprise you.
Yeah, I had heard it was good. Yeah, I keep hearing good things about it. I love that it just came out and you've already watched it, quote, multiple times with your children.
Yeah, that's how weekends go around here. Yeah. It's either that or Legend of Zelda. We have to choose our screen time.
We should, I mean, I'm curious what your kids think about the Zelda movie.
Oh my God. They ask me every day when the Zelda movie's going to come out. And I'm like, many years from now.
I know plenty of adults who are asking that question. So,
yeah.
What do you think about the Zelda movie, Richard? This wasn't on our lineup, but now I want to know your thoughts.
I mean, live action is that's okay. That's a big swing. And I think it brings up a whole lot of other questions about like, how those characters are designed and what country they're designed in, and like, how do you cast in the kind of appropriate way for the, you know, I don't know, but I think they've got their work set out for them. I think as an animated movie, that's a lot easier to do. And also there is the problem also that in the games, Link never talks. He kind of grunts otherwise reacts, but does not have dialogue in the way that Zelda and other characters do. So I don't know how you handle that, but yeah, I mean, it is, as you told your kids, a long way off. And actually far away enough that they might not care anymore when it comes out.
I don't know. We haven't even gotten to Tears of the Kingdom yet. So we've got many hours of Zelda ahead.
I would bet a game will be nicely timed to the release of that movie.
They are good at marketing over there at Nintendo.
I also support the Hunter Schafer casting petitions.
As Zelda.
She's got the look.
I'm a new Zelda player. I haven't even gotten to actually meet Zelda. We're just following Link around in the countryside. So
she's already having to like comment on it, like being asked on red carpets. And again, this movie.
And is she like putting herself out there for it, or
she's like, sure, like sure. Sounds great.
It's hard to imagine saying no, thank you at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think the early expectation is that will be a hit of some kind.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Well, I'll be spending a good chunk of Thanksgiving playing Breath of the Wild with my children. But we did want to close close this week's episode kind of talking about the concept of Thanksgiving movies and screener movies, which I think we talk about a lot without necessarily defining our terms, and maybe we don't need to. But I always remember what Mike Hogan, original host of this podcast, used to say about people putting on a disc in their Bel Air mansions with the sun streaming through the windows and a movie that can grab their attention otherwise. That, to me, is kind of the definition of a movie that plays well on a screener. Do you guys have your own personal ideas of, like, what makes a movie something that you feel confident will translate even in that format?
If my mom can come periodically into the TV room after being in the kitchen for 20 minutes and sort of be able to follow the story, great. You know, my mom will see maybe a third of the movie and like it, you know. Or sometimes she'll come in to check in on things and then sit and watch the rest of the movie.
Mm.
I mean, I think the holdovers, well, I want to see that in theaters with them, you know. One risk I was maybe considering taking if I get a screener of it is May December.
Mm.
Kind of borderline.
That's for the grown-ups only Thanksgiving.
Yeah, right. Oh, exactly. Yeah. I mean, there are no little ones in my family at the moment. So, but I think that, like, you know, that kind of broad accessibility, or, like, you know, many quadrant sort of appeal, is always a good way to go. You know, a war film always goes down well with my father, you know, but I think really looking at the kind of crop of stuff out there, Flower Moon is too long, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But Holdovers really, that's not a short movie either, but, like, it's over 2 hours. But, like, I think Holdovers is funny, heartwarming. It's holiday-ish, you know, it's over Christmas. And I think that's the clear front runner for me, but maybe I'm forgetting something.
Just don't call it Cozy.
No, God, yeah. No.
Penalty of death.
As we learned on this podcast. For me, it's two genres, comedies and biopics, I think, tend to be really, I mean, I guess with the exception of, like, Oppenheimer, although apparently that would be fine based on the way it's performed. But those are two, I think, really safe, accessible genres, and to Richard's point, the kinds where you can dip in and out a little bit. I'm bummed American Fiction is not a part of the Thanksgiving holiday as it was originally planned to be. Obviously, understandable why, but I think that would have been a perfect long weekend theatrical experience for families, especially because it's a little barbed, but it's also got a real heart, and it is a family
story.
It's
about family, yeah.
Yeah.
Does it happen over Thanksgiving? I'm trying to remember if there's, like, a holiday in the midst of all the family stuff.
It's kind of summery, right?
You're right. They're at Martha's Vineyard. Yeah.
Yeah. No, excuse me, Katie, they're on the South Shore. They're in Situate.
Oh, my goodness.
How dare you?
All right, Massachusetts.
There also is something fun. I mean, maybe American Fiction will have to be held for Christmas, you know, for viewing with family. But, like, I know in my mom sees a lot more movies these days than she used to. But, like, in years past, it was like, if we would watch something over Thanksgiving or Christmas and then that movie was in the Oscar race for the rest of the season, my mom would be like, oh, remember, we saw that together. You know, that kind of thing. Like, when you're, it's kind of like your family's picking a horse for the campaign, you know, basically. And so I think any of the movies we've already mentioned do have that same also awardsy tie-in, which is nice.
It's funny because I'm already at home, so I was able to run this question by my parents in person. But they have already seen The Holdovers, which I think was the one I was definitely sure I was going to show them, because I remember seeing it in Telluride and being like, this is the perfect family holiday film.
Mm-hmm. Did they love it?
They loved it. My dad asked me for the soundtrack. And my parents do this thing where they say, I hear this is getting awards attention. I'm like, that is my job, Mom. I can tell you that. but I don't know who they're hearing it from. But they like to tell me what's getting awards attention. So, but I talked to them both, and they're both interested in both Oppenheimer and Killers of the Flower Moon because they didn't want us in the theater for three plus hours.
Uh-huh.
And so those are movies they would consider screeners, perhaps over more than one evening. I'm sure the filmmakers would love to hear that. But, you know, I hadn't really considered that as, like, oh, that would be a good screener situation either for now or Christmas for them. And then I would love to show them Past Lives, which they haven't, you know, they missed, and I think would be a really enjoyable at home viewing as well.
Yeah, that's a great one that I think would translate really nicely. Even, you know, hopefully you don't walk in and out, but Richard, I can imagine your mom getting sucked in if she came in.
Yeah, that would be a sit down. Yeah, she would sit down. I mean, I think the funny thing, remember there were some movie theaters that got in trouble for doing an intermission in Flower Moon. Yeah. And then they had to, like, the studio intervened and they had to stop doing
Thelma.
That.
Thelma was not happy.
Right, oh, man. Yes. But you can't stop that in the house.
Right, right. You can't tell me when you go to the bathroom.
You could press pause and have lunch and then come back to it. You know, if you wanted to, maybe you'll be so sucked in you won't want to, you'll just want to watch it through. But yeah, I don't know, it's a funny thing. And I think that, like, also because I'm sort of captive at home and, like, there's nowhere to go, I mean, really, you know, like, it's been in the past a good opportunity for me to catch up with documentaries and international titles, you know, because it's like, well, what else am I doing? And so maybe take a few risks there. Like, I have a screener for The Teacher's Lounge, which I know, Katie, you really liked in Toronto.
Oh, yeah. David, I know
you,
too.
I love that.
Oh, David, too. Yeah, yeah. So I was thinking of maybe doing that because my parents do like foreign films and I, you know, it's a perfect time slot to watch it.
That is a great pick. Mm-hmm. I promise you will not regret that.
Yeah, it's quick and it's gripping and yeah, that'll go well.
Length is a kind of interesting question. Like, I find for myself, like if I'm taking A Killers of the Flower Moon, for example, I know if I had not, like say it were just a movie that came out that I missed, like I would be very unlikely to watch it at home because I'm kind of always thinking about how much time I'm dedicating to it in the moment. And I think about, like, Netflix's output over the last few years, at least on the award side, and it does feel like there's always this kind of tight two-hour cutoff, like Power of the Dog was at 2 hours, Maestro is at 2 hours. And I think that there's probably something to that. I don't know how much of that is the filmmakers and how much of that is the studio. And, of course, the filmmakers, I'm sure, have the final say. But there is something to that, and I do wonder, especially as movies like Napoleon, which will be 4 hours on Apple from what we've heard. Right. Yeah. Apple's just like, here you go. No limit to how long these can be. You know, how they will play, especially over the holidays, because it's a big investment and people who maybe haven't paid as much attention, who missed them in theaters and click on that, you know, icon in their Apple TV or however they watch it will be like, oh, so that's the night then.
Well, let me suggest a way for you to watch a long movie in segments with the filmmaker's approval, because Baz Luhrmann recut Australia into a Hulu series.
I knew this was coming.
it's called A Film in Segments, Not a Limited Series, at least according. So I interviewed him as part of a press day last week, and that they were very clear on. I think you could call it a limited series personally, but far be it from me. I was a big defender of Australia back in 2008. I have no idea where any of you land on this movie. You've probably forgotten about it entirely, as most people have.
I liked it fine. I remembered it.
Yeah, it is a good time in five segments. You can go back and see Baby Ben Mendelsohn, who I forgot was in it entirely. Nicole Kidman and Hugh Jackman looking unbelievably great. And then you don't have to worry about Thelma Shoemaker yelling at you if you watch it in segments. So,
Katie, weren't you just on This Had Oscar Buzz talking about it?
I was completely by coincidence, because I had been badgering to do that. I was on their Patreon. They do exceptions. And Australia did get a costumes nomination, a very well-deserved one. So technically not a This Had Oscar Buzz project, but yeah, you can hear me talk more about it there.
And the show is called, what, Far Away Downs?
Far Away Downs, which is the name of the cattle ranch that they have out in the outback.
That I did not remember.
There's a lot you might be surprised if you pick that one back up. But to go back to theaters, I was also just going to throw out, and I think I had not realized this until now, but Maestro is in theaters to some extent this weekend. And yes. I think it's the only Oscar contender with Thanksgiving as part of the film. So maybe that alone is reason to go see it this weekend. Yes.
Snoopy makes a cameo. That's a good option, too, I think, depending on the bent of your family, you know, like if...
And where it's playing.
And where it's playing, of course. Yeah. Yeah. I probably will not be playing in Providence where I will be, but... something to maybe hold for Christmas.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess probably by Christmas, it'll be on Netflix. It has to be out there at some point. But I mean, seeing that in the theater, I was so glad that I did. It sounds unbelievable. So it's really worth it for people if they want to seek it out. And it's not quite as long as Killers of the Flower Moon.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor,
Let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as the regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after the regime airs.
Okay, David, to close out the show, you talked to Vanessa Kirby, who is such a standout in Napoleon. I feel like she's the main thing I keep hearing about. And I think we all know her scene stealing abilities from The Crown and the Mission Impossible movies. I haven't seen Napoleon yet, but I'm incredibly excited to see what she has to offer in this movie.
Yeah. Speaking of interesting Thanksgiving releases, this is out in theaters via Sony and Apple this weekend. And yeah, Vanessa Kirby is amazing in it and holds the screen pretty much every second that the camera's on her, even when it's, you know, maybe going in a bit of a strange direction. Because certainly when I watched this movie, my first thought was, what did the scenes look like between Joaquin Phoenix and Vanessa Kirby before the camera started rolling? Because the energy of them is not what I think anybody expected. And for me, in the best way, but definitely one that I think would require a level of prep that maybe I wouldn't have expected for a movie like this.
Well, yeah, I cannot wait to hear what was going on over there, what was going on that massive set. So let's hear your conversation with Napoleon's Vanessa Kirby.
Vanessa Kirby, welcome to Little Gold Man to talk about Napoleon. When I saw this movie, it your scenes especially, I was so surprised, and I've said this on the podcast, by how funny they were at times. So I did just want to jump right in and start with the dynamic between you and Joaquin. Was it as funny between you as it looked for us watching? Because it's also very intense, but the comedy's pretty central.
Mm-hmm. I don't know whether we planned for it to be that way, but I think it sort of naturally started evolving because it felt human.
Yeah.
Almost the more extreme a circumstance, the more absurd in a way. And therefore, to kind of counteract the deep pain and the brutality of everything, it felt like naturally, yeah, you sort of offset it as a human, or try to. So that started happening naturally. And I think it also probably came from the fact that we, in between scenes, because it was, as you say, so intense, we would laugh together a lot. And so I'm sure that kind of was sort of interchanging all the time.
Yeah. There's also such a fascinating power differential between these characters. I mean, when you go into a movie called Napoleon, about Napoleon, you're expecting this epic portrait of this brutal, world-changing general. And instead, in your scenes, you get this portrait of this really resolute, strong woman in Josephine, and this very insecure, at times very strange man in Napoleon. In terms of finding that dynamic with him, and just in your own research, like, how did you think of this marriage and how did you play it with him?
Mm. I think we both felt it was one of the most fascinating and contradictory and complex relationships we'd ever come across. I urge anyone to, you know, go in and sort of explore it more, because
yes,
it was such a, you know, his letters, for example, even as a starting point, it's kind of unbelievable that you have this, you know, as you say, the sort of military general who's out there on the battlefield, you know, a genius at military strategy, but also instigating war and conquering land, and then rushing back to his tent to write these letters, which almost feel adolescent in their obsessive, yes, compulsive nature. I mean, he wrote to her nearly every day, and she didn't write to him back in the early days at all. And it was so interesting looking at their, you know, decades long relationship and how dependent they were on each other, codependent, really, I think we felt. And therefore the kind of the power shifts within it, and the need to possess, and all the things that make it not a the relationship and the arc of the relationship, not a kind of continually maturing and deepening, mm-hmm. but more a fusing with each other and a need. And I think in any relationship where there's extreme need and there's something unhealed in them as individuals, when they come together, there's inevitably going to be something that's naturally volatile, I would say.
Hmm. Not to say that that would also describe your dynamic with Joaquin in the making of this movie, but I am curious. I know you've talked about the openness you had with each other to kind of let loose a little bit and go off of what was on the script and play the scene as you felt it. I believe the slap in the movie, for instance, was improvised. So what kinds of things came up in all that? And what was the level of, I suppose, safety between you that allowed you to go there?
Mm-hmm. I think like with any kind of, as a group of actors, when you go on a journey that you know is going to involve, you know, painful things in a psyche to explore or dynamic, it reminded me of, it always reminds me of when you go do a play and you go do something like Streetcar Named Desire, and you know by the end of the play, Blanche, as your sister, is committed to a mental asylum and has slept with your husband, if you were playing Stella, you know, and and Ben Foster and Gillian Anderson and I did that show once in London in New York, and I remember us having a kind of togetherness in exploring something that's searingly painful. And that togetherness really helps when you're going to those places. I felt it in a movie, Shia LaBeouf and I did it at Pieces of a Woman. We also had that. And it's a sense of, I guess, knowing that you're there for each other, despite the realms that you have to go to that are uncomfortable and really unpleasant and sometimes very tough. Hmm.
Is there anything you remember on your end bringing into those scenes that kind of came up in the filming of them?
You know, the editor reminded me the other day that I've completely forgotten, and I reminded Joaquin and he had also forgotten, but in this sort of, there was a sequence of scenes that all set over one night after he throws her out and finds out that she's had an affair. Mm-hmm. And the editor said, oh, you know, some of those takes on the sofa were 9 minutes long. And I said to her, oh, my goodness, really? I couldn't remember what we did. And she said, oh, you guys did everything. And, you know, she had to find a 20-second scene between them within the parameters of everything that we had shot. And so I said, oh, I do remember. I think I screamed in his face. I think there was lots of tears. I think there's lots of. Yeah, so I know that we did a lot within the different, because I think the main reason why is because the relationship never felt like you could draw on a graph. You know, it just was fluctuating so much where he was absolutely obsessed with her and she wasn't sure about him. And then the power dynamic completely shifted. And then he needed her. And then when he, you know, it's sort of, really recorded that he believed, and as she did, I found this bit so fascinating in destiny and in the sort of predestined, ordained nature of their relationship. She had a palm reader when she was 13 on the island. She grew up in Martinique, and two friends were with her, and they all documented it separately that this palm reader had told her she would become empress. And they were all really confused by it at the time because empress wasn't a word that was coined. And so she always had the sense that she had to go to Paris and claim something, some kind of greatness within her that I think then she saw in him and he saw in her. And so there was that aspect of their relationship that was, in a way, always going to be insecure because it was this idea of becoming powerful together, and that is always going to be unstable in some ways because it's not requires external circumstances. And so because of that and the sort of micro fluctuations in power between both of them, both internally together and then in relationship to this idea of empire, which couldn't be on a more extreme scale, it's going to be inherently volatile. And so each scene could be played in different ways, depending on where they're at exactly in that moment, both individually and together. So I think we tried to play things in as many sort of different ways as possible in case there was a journey there that we hadn't missed out on by the time we came to the end.
Yeah. It's fascinating to hear you say that because it really comes across in the movie, this feeling of you can't pin them down. You certainly can't pin Josephine down, who, you know, she has that uncertainty. And I had these moments watching it where I'm like, what is she thinking right now as Joaquin is doing something particularly bizarre across from her, maybe. And I imagine that's pretty fun to play, too, is you could really take it in a lot of directions.
Yeah, you know, I thought when I was starting out on the journey of trying to, I played a real character before in The Crown, and
of course
I'd so loved the research process, and every single thing that I read about her all pointed to the same nature of person. And each account I'd read, whether it would be, you know, some salacious sort of tabloidy type book about her, or someone within the palace who had, you know, faithfully written this account of these two princesses, and all these different versions, essentially she was, it all accumulated to become one whole. And obviously I had footage mm-hmm. and recordings and things of her, so it was sort of easier in a way. And I thought the same thing would happen with Josephine, but it was so strange. Every single book I read about her was a completely different angle and often contradicted the one I just read. Wow. And David, it was so confusing because I thought, oh my God, okay, wait, maybe by the fifth book it will give me, it will kind of consolidate all those versions I read of her, but it didn't.
Yeah.
And then as you start to, if you looked at her life and all the different, she almost lived six lifetimes in one as a statistically a human being would. She was, a young girl, grew up on a tiny Caribbean island, very free, you know, grew up eating sugar cane. She lost all her teeth because of it. And I did wear a mouth guard in the movie, but because she didn't smile with her teeth, you don't really see it. So in the film, I mean, don't really smile with my teeth a lot.
For the character, you know, internal.
No one ever thought. But we did play a few moments, actually, where Joaquin and I played with that, but they're not in the film. But anyway, then she was, you know, she traveled from Martinique and on her own left her family at 16 to marry this total stranger who was an aristocrat, had two children with him, was shut at home, barely let out the house, and then they all were imprisoned and she was nearly executed. Her husband was beheaded and she watched it, and then was released and became part of the you know, a fashion icon at the center of women's sort of liberation, and and had lots of affairs with many different generals, including Barras, who was the head of the at the time. And then met Napoleon. And so there's all these different versions of her. And yes. I realized that because for a nature of personality to have lived so many different phases or conditions in life and be able to adapt, most people would stay the course of really who they are and not be able to fit into certain, you know, different, would sort of drop off from whatever the next phase was. But she managed, and that taught me that she must be such a master adapter. And a master adapter to me is able to repress so many of, is able to hide a lot of what they actually think, because otherwise you'd be outed straight away. You know, you wouldn't be able to shapeshift like that. But that is, to play as an actor, it was so tricky because I just thought, oh my goodness, how do you bury something and make something ephemeral and able to navigate or manipulate your internal life in order to be okay, you know?
So it's so interesting. And hearing you say that, it makes me wonder how you found applying that to Ridley's filming style. Because he, from what I understand, I imagine it was the same in this movie, uses a lot of cameras and does not use a lot of takes. And given what you're saying about Josephine, probably any choice would feel like a bit of a leap to begin with. But then you might not have as many chances to do those different things. So how did you negotiate that in your head?
Yeah, so true. And it was tough. I hadn't worked that quickly before.
Yeah.
Sometimes there might be 11 cameras is the, wow. the most we'll use. And so you might do it once or twice. And I love going as many times as possible because you never feel like you quite hit it. And there's always so much to explore, you know, some of which might be no good at all. It was on the one hand kind of extraordinary because if something really magic happened, all the cameras would capture it and you wouldn't have to recreate somehow or try and hit something again. But as you say, the when you're playing someone mercurial like that, it's you just hope to dear God that she has enough internal life that you see inside of it because of the nature of it's harder to make one specific bold choice in the moment because you want her to have that kind of mercurial type energy. But Joaquin and I have talked about the fact that there is also the nature of the world was so fast moving and intense and brutal that the pace of the filming was also, I think, added to the sense of that somehow. So it was actually really useful and kind of thrilling in a way.
Yeah, it's like jumping off a cliff, kind of, with 12 cameras on you at all times. So one thing I love about your work in this film and generally in period work is it is in no way in that sort of stuffy, typically period vein. There's a real liveness to it. And I think of The Crown that you were mentioning as well as this. And I think that's a pretty active goal of yours in projects like this. So with a role like this and a film like this, what are you looking at to not fall into period traps, to make this feel modern and fresh?
Mm-hmm. I think I was really influenced by two directors that I worked with in theatre when I was doing theatre for a long time before I ever did screen. One is an Australian director called Benedict Andrews, who I love. And another one is Rob Icke, who's also extraordinary. And they both work in a way where they take these classic plays and they adapt them to feel essentially like as if when Chekhov was writing and his plays were on, it was extremely modern and controversial for people at the time. And so their argument would always be, why should we feel when we watch Chekhov now like it's a dusty museum kind of archive piece that we're looking into the past? We should feel as if Chekhov intended it for it to feel like it's us now and how we could relate to that. And I think I was really lucky in sort of being influenced like that, because I always feel when approaching period, I feel like what is the same essential humanness that's being explored here just because we happen to be wearing different clothes and it happens to be different conditions in society. And so Joaquin and I talked about that a lot too, that we didn't want it to be a conventional period relationship. You know, we wanted it to be strange and unusual and unpredictable and not to think too much about the external trappings, if you know what I mean, of that.
It's also, I think, a part of how Ridley Scott tends to approach historical dramas. He's given some quotes of late, essentially saying sticking to the narrative is not important. I mean, I'm definitely paraphrasing here. His is a little bit more colorful, as I'm sure you can imagine. but what are your feelings on that generally? On, you know, obviously you did a ton of research. I'm sure you all did. But then you have to make a movie and there are some, not necessarily shortcuts, but choices that have to be made to make the best film you can.
I think it's like with anything, isn't it? It's an interpretation of an exploration of a psyche. Really, whether you decide to do a modern adaptation of Shakespeare or you decide to keep it in that era or, you know, you set it in a completely different country. I mean, I just feel like it's, to me, it's always going to be a fictional version.
Yeah.
And I think we all felt that on The Crown because we were having these conversations behind closed doors, which between, you know, Peter would say, look, I know as much as I possibly can about the facts, but the conversations that happen around those facts, we have no idea about. And so in a way, it's just one group of people coming together as an alchemy to interpret that. And my interpretation of Napoleon, you know, as one actress that happens to be joining one thing about him of all the many, many, many things that have been written and discussed. And when you read a book, a historian offers a different angle on the nature of the man based on so many different factors. But for me, I guess I would, as much as I would respect his sort of genius mind and be in awe of this, of his determination to do what he did with his life, I will always look at it through the lens of, it's a man who went to war a lot, you know, and that isn't something that I will always have my own angle on that, really. And so that's my individual specific opinion, but I don't know if that wouldn't necessarily influence the film as a whole. So I think that's just one example of sort of how each person is going to interpret it completely different. I wish there was more of this, or think it should be this. Or, why didn't it stick to this bit? But the truth is, when you read as many books as you can about this man, this incredibly famous man, and, you know, a counterpoint in Josephine, it's like with all the books I read on her, just there wasn't one definitive way of clarifying exactly who she was as a person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In all of this, in the playfulness that you're talking about of playing these scenes, in the brevity of some of these takes, like, how did you find Ridley as a director, a collaborator? He's obviously a unique and, I think, special personality. But of course, you're filming, again, like, really intense stuff.
He's so brilliant. I mean, he's a master. I'd always wanted to work with him. I was so delighted when he rang me. I instantly said yes. And he is so accomplished that he storyboards everything before, and I came on quite late in the process, and so I said, oh, Ridley, I would love all your storyboards, and I printed them all out and put them on my wall at home, because I wanted to know what he had in his mind and what we had to get inside of. And when somebody puts a, you know, 8 cameras on a scene in a space, and it's a small sort of intimate scene, you know, he's cutting as he's going. So there's just, you're in such capable, robust hands. So it feels very held, even though the nature of what you're exploring, you know, we might be going at a fast pace, or we're exploring something difficult. You know that there's, you can kind of relax in that sense, because you've got someone who's just so in command of it and knows exactly what he wants.
Yeah.
And he's just really warm and loving, and there was a familial relationship between him and Joaquin, because obviously they worked together so long ago. So it was a really beautiful thing to sort of witness and be a part of.
Lovely. So he's talked a little bit about this longer cut that's coming, I think, to Apple, and there have been some hints about your prominence perhaps in that cut. I'm curious what you can share just about maybe charting more of Josephine's story even than we see in this theatrical version, and what it was like perhaps to have this kind of robust experience, and maybe or maybe not see even more of that to come.
Yeah, you know, it's, David, it's quite hard to remember actually what, and also to not know which way, as when you shoot any movie, there's so many different ways it can be edited. So I haven't asked Ridley yet, actually, what he's kind of aiming for. And I know that he's editing at the moment, and so I'm really interested to see what will be revealed in that version. And it could be longer scenes. It could be different cuts of scenes. There were lots of sequences and scenes we filmed that couldn't make the movie because it was just too long.
Yeah.
It spans so many years. So I don't know what it's going to... what it's going to be. I'm as much in the dark as you, I think.
Oh, but, okay.
But there's definitely Josephine's life before meeting Napoleon. I think we did film, you know, long sequences of that.
And that's, I would imagine, stuff that would have helped you unlock, you know, what we were talking about earlier, is how she became who she became, whatever that looks like scene to scene.
Totally. I think, for example, everything that I studied about her informed how she was able to survive. The main word that kept coming up in everything was survivor, and I thought, what is the nature of that and what does that mean for her? And when you read about the things that she was able to navigate and persevere at, that I would have honestly day two collapsed and not been able to continue somehow. But even that she was in prison and she cut off all her hair because the women talked about how if the hair would get stuck in the blade if you don't cut your hair. And so she was sort of hacked off her hair and she was 24 hours away from being killed. And her husband had been, many, many of her friends had been. They were all in one prison and a lot of the women had to sleep with the other men because they wanted to get pregnant so that they wouldn't be executed. And she did all those things. And so when she left prison, to me, that was Napoleon was meeting someone who had come so close to death and had witnessed death and had even cut her own hair off because she imagined the guillotine taking off her head. That's a particular kind of person, you know, that mm-hmm. is a person that is resilient and has come close to something incredibly frightening and has met it, you know, and confronted it so acutely. And to me, that I always thought, God, the kind of quiet strength that person would have and that experience and the kind of weight of being a survivor when so many of your friends didn't, that I felt would inform the rest of her life. And so I wanted that nature of personality and somehow for Napoleon to identify this sort of outsider that wasn't part of Parisian society, was not an aristocrat herself. She warns him in one of the scenes, you know, I'm not clean, is what we talked about. Yeah. She felt about herself and do you accept me as that? And he feels the same. I think they came from these little islands. Mm-hmm. They didn't come from French society. They invaded it and sort of, you know, managed to infiltrate it and then take over this sort of empire. And so that those sort of psyches, to me, it felt so interesting that these two were drawn together like magnets, even though it was volatile and dysfunctional and difficult. There was an immense recognition. And I think that recognition in a way felt like love and felt like this long-standing, deep, deep love, which was there. But it was a sense of, I know you and I see you and you see me and we're in this together now and we're in it. And I think it was so interesting reading the books about how he suddenly started losing battles the minute that he divorced Josephine and everything kind of crumbled. And that was really interesting, is what about these two psyches needed each other in order to do what they did? And how did they unlock that in each other?
That does it for this week's show. Happy Thanksgiving once again. We'll be back next week. Find us in the meantime at Vanity Fair, VF Awards Insider on social media. I am at Katie Rich and Richard.
Rylaws.
And David.
David Canfield 97.
And Rebecca.
Rebecca M. Ford.
Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs.
And this week's award for Best Oscars Host Suggestion goes to Katie Rich.
An iguana who is a class pet.
Ever wanted to go inside the Met Gala? I'm Cho Minardi, and this week on The Run Through with Vogue, we take you inside the world's most exclusive and glamorous party. We'll talk about the best looks from the red carpet and everything that happened after. Listen to The Run Through with Vogue wherever you get your podcasts.